Hello, everyone, and a happy Lag BaOmer to each and every one of you, and thank you for tuning in. I imagine since it's Lag BaOmer that we can talk about the holiday of Shavuot, which is upcoming in a little more than 2 weeks. Shavuot is a different holiday than the other holidays of the Jewish year. It's not marked with any special commandment, any special ritual, and therefore it was filled in by the Jewish people with many, many beautiful customs. And in Judaism, after a while, the custom becomes the, main point itself. It's the Talmud tells us minag mevatel halacha, that a custom even can overrule halacha in certain cases. So here, the custom has overruled everything regarding Shavuot, and I'd like to discuss a few of the customs, but some of the ideas of Shavuot as well. We all know that Shavuot is the anniversary of the granting of the Torah to the Jewish people on Sinai. Even though the first Shavuot, the first granting of the Torah on Sinai was on the seventh day of Sivan and not on the sixth, because Moshe added a day. That's a whole conversation how Moshe was entitled to do it, but he did it and it passed muster. And because of that, we celebrate Shavuot on the sixth day of Sivan. In the diaspora, we celebrate it on both days, the sixth and the seventh. But in Israel, we only have the sixth day. The Chatam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, remarks that since the real, quote-unquote, day of Shavuot is the seventh day of Sivan, then the second day of the holiday in the diaspora is to be treated with the same stringencies as the first day itself. It is more stringent, in his opinion, than, let us say, the second day of Sukkot or Simchat Torah or the second day of Pesach or the last day of Pesach, because that's the actual anniversary. So Shavuot is the anniversary of the giving of the Torah. Now, what happened then? It's hard to know from the Torah itself. The Torah says that everybody was present, everybody heard it, it was an awesome event, frightening, terror-filled, and there's a great piece that the Rambam Maimonides, in his Mora Nevuchim, which is badly translated in English as Guide to the Perplexed, and the Rambam discusses that. What happened? How was the Torah given? What did the Jewish people hear? And not surprisingly, our teacher Moshe becomes the hero of the entire event. In fact, it would not be out of line to say that the holiday of Shavuot is the holiday of Moshe. He's the man. He is the one that carried the Jewish people, and he is the one who gave us the Torah. And therefore, the prophet says, Zichru Toras Moshe Avdi. Remember the Torah of my servant Moshe. The Ribbono Shel Olam, so to speak, gives up his ownership of the Torah in favor of Moshe being the prime force in bringing and teaching the Torah to the Jewish people. So Maimonides says as follows. He says that on the mountain of Sinai, when Moshe ascended the mountain, and a great noise was heard, a sound that has never been heard before in human history and has never been heard since. And this great sound was the method of the communication of the Creator with the created. It was the method by which God informed the Jewish people of their special mission and of their particular obligations. And it also was the message that emanated to all civilization, to all peoples, through Moshe. And therefore, Maimonides posits that there was this great sound, and the great sound included all of the words and letters of the Torah, of what we call the Ten Commandments. All of that was in this great sound. But because this great sound was so awesome and mighty, it was indistinguishable. The Jewish people only heard the sound. They did not hear anything. And therefore, it was Moshe who was able to come down from the mountain, to go to the bottom of the mountain where the Jewish people stood, and to decipher for them the sound that they heard into the holy letters of the Torah, into the holy letters of the Ten Commandments. And therefore, that is how we got the Torah. And that's why the Jewish people said to Moshe, we don't want to go through this again, because this sound is so awesome. It puts us in a danger for our own existence, that you take care of it, right? You'll come down and explain everything to us, but we don't want to go through such an event again because of the terror that the sound brought upon us. Now, the Rambam himself raises the question. We all know that the Talmud says that the first two commandments, so to speak, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I'm the Lord your God, and Lo Yielecho Elohim Acherim Al Ponoi, you shall not have any other gods except for our Creator. Those two, the Talmud says, the Jewish people heard. So what does that mean that they heard? The Rambam just said that, that they didn't hear anything. They only heard this enormous sound that so frightened them. The Medrash says that their souls were about to flee their body. In other words, it's a near-death experience, so to speak. And so how do we reconcile what the Talmud says with what the Rambam says? So Maimonides himself answers, he raises the point, and he says that it's his opinion that the sound that Moshe explained to the Jewish people had to deal and had to do with these first two commandments, the commandment of Anochi and the commandment of Lo Yielecho. That is what Moshe explained to the Jewish people when he came down and stood with them at the bottom of the mountain. Then Moshe himself ascended the mountain, and he heard the other eight commandments, and he came down, and he gave over those eight other commandments to the Jewish people, but the Jewish people did not hear the sound anymore that encompass those eight commandments. So, in effect, we have here that this is Moshe's show, so to speak. He's the one who's taking care of everything. And God said to Moshe before, "V'gam b'cho yaminu li'olam." Through this event, the Jewish people will believe in you forever, which has been borne out in truth throughout Jewish history. Throughout our existence as a people, we're Moshe's people. And Moshe is more than the lawgiver, as he is phrased in popular terms. Moshe is our representative. Moshe is the one that brought the Torah down to us and gave it structure and meaning and taught us all of its rules, and was the person who, more than any other human being, dealt with God, so to speak, face to face. So that's a special quality that never has happened again. That's why the Talmud says that Moshe was the father of all of the prophets. of those who preceded him and those who succeeded him, because Moshe, in the sound of God, so to speak, in the tremendous cacophony of noise that was the revelation on Sinai, Moshe was able to decipher the words and to grant them to the Jewish people. And that's the Rambam's take on the matter, and many of the great scholars of Israel have agreed with him, though there are other interpretations, and it wouldn't be Jewish if there wouldn't be other interpretations as to what happened. But that's one that I really wanted to share with you, because often we don't think of it in those terms. We think in terms that God spoke the Ten Commandments word by word, and that's how we heard it, and et cetera, et cetera. By the way, this is a method of, so to speak, an excuse for the Jewish people. The Talmud says that the Jewish people have an excuse for violating the Torah, God forbid, because they were forced into it. Modo rabo lo raisa, the Gemara says. So they have a great excuse that they can say because they were forced into it. The Lord hung the mountain over their head. They're hearing this tremendous sound. They're just out of it. And therefore, when the first temple was destroyed, the Jewish people had the ability to say to God, as many of them did, listen, we quit, that's it. The covenant is over. We accepted the covenant on the basis that we were going to have the land of Israel and that we were going to be an independent nation. Now that we're not, that has been taken, stripped from us. We don't have the strength anymore to go on. And our acceptance of the Torah is therefore nullified. It was conditional, and it was forced upon us, coerced upon us. You can't hold us to it. And the Talmud seems to agree that legally the Jewish people had such a claim. However, in the time of Ezra, and we read it in the Megillah of Esther, in the book of Esther, so it says, Kimu v'kiblu ayuhudim aleim valzarum valkol anilvim. The Jewish people accepted now the Torah willingly. They accepted the Torah knowing that there's a Haman in the world. They know that they're in trouble. They know they're in an exile because Purim happened when the Jewish people were in exile in Persia and Babylonia. And so now there are no excuses. It's an unconditional acceptance of the Torah. So Shavuos, therefore, is a commemoration not only of the original Matan Torah, but it's a commemoration as well of the acceptance of the Torah, which binds us, which is the Torah that was accepted at the time of Ezra and at the beginning of the Second Temple. Now, in the holiday of Shavuos, as it is recorded for us in the Torah, we have, it's an agricultural holiday. It was harvest time. It's one of the great facets of Judaism is that it's attached to a particular land. And the attachment of the Jewish people to the land of Israel is not to be understood only in terms of national existence, right? That's our homeland, which it is. But it's not only because we're a nation there, or not only because of all of its historical sites, which do exist there. I remember that once I had a conversation with the Satmarov, and there was another Jew in there, and he interrupted to say that he didn't believe that the graves and the archaeology of the land of Israel as represented by the Zionists really was true, and that, for instance, he said the grave of the prophet Samuel over Ramot here near Jerusalem, he said, oh, they, you know, it's a fake. And the Rebbe turned to him and with his clever smile said to him, he said, I don't know if he's there or not, but I can tell you for certain he's not in Williamsburg. He's not in Brooklyn. And the relationship to the land of Israel is not built upon just graves or archaeology or that we were once there. That's all insufficient. The Torah made the land of Israel a holy place, so that the land of Israel is a personality. It has its own persona. It exists on its own. And the Torah itself describes it that way. Eretz asher eini Hashem elokecha, born the Reishis Shona, Ad Achus Shona, the Rivono Shalom is always there, searching for it. So the land is holy, but not in the sense of the holy land the way, for instance, the Christian world sees it. It's not the holy land because somebody was once here or because holy events occurred here. It's a holy land because the land is holy. And the land is special. It's different than any other land that exists on the face of the planet. And therefore, the agricultural laws that the Torah prescribes for us are part of that holiness. The Torah itself, we will read in this week's Torah reading, the Torah itself says that the land is entitled to observe the Sabbath, so to speak. It also has to have a time of rest. The land is an individual person. It's something that really exists. It's not just a place. It's not just a piece of earth, but it is in itself a value and a home for the Jewish people. And a holy place. I think that the part of the reason that we have the problems that we do within the Jewish world and certainly without the Jewish world, outside of the Jewish world, as to how to judge the state of Israel and the millions of Jews who are fortunate enough to live here. And if you judge it as being just another country and just another land, and that all of these things are, it's an argument between Sweden and Norway, well, then, you missed the point. You don't really understand what the issue is here, and you can't understand the depths of the issue. And therefore, to a certain extent, Jewish people look to be unreasonable, right? Well, why don't you just, give it up? Why don't you go home? The Palestinians tell us, just go back to Europe, right? As though we belong in Europe. This idea of the holiness of the land is part of the holiday of Shavuos, perhaps more than any of the other holidays, because of the fact that mehochel chermesh bakoma, people have to work, they have to till the land. We're talking about produce. It's the Chag HaBikurim. It's the holiday that we have to bring the first fruit from the land. So we bring the first fruit of the land there is holy, right? You bring it to the temple. It's not just an apple or an orange or grain or whatever. It has holiness to it. It has special quality to it. And throughout the Jewish experience in the exile that we were forced to live in for 2,000 years, the Jews treasured any agricultural product that came from the land of Israel. Anyone. And I've often told the story that Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the head of the yeshiva in Valozhin, and he was also one of the leaders of the Chovev Etzion, of the Lovers of Zion in the 1800s, way before political Zionism, before Herzl. It was the Chovev Etzion, Rabbi Shmuel Moelever, who interested the Baron Rothschild in the project to support the agricultural settlements in the land of Israel. So anyway, the Baron made a wine company, which is today the famous Carmel Wine Company. And in 1882, the first bottle of wine was produced. And as a sign of affection and honor and respect, the first bottle of wine was sent by the Baron to the Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin in Valozhin, deep in Belarus. and the nephew of Rabbi Berlin, who was Rabbi Boruch Halevi Epstein, the author of the Torah Tmima, and he was he lived in the house with the Netziver. He was a nephew of his. He said when the bottle of wine arrived, the bottle of wine from the land of Israel, grown by Jewish farmers, upon which all of the agricultural laws of the Torah had been performed, the Netziv went into his bedroom and changed into his Sabbath clothing in honor of a bottle of wine that came from the land of Israel. And one of the great miracles that we see amongst all of the miracles that are the land of Israel today and the state of Israel, it's all miraculous here, absolutely miraculous. But one of the miracles is that a country that was barren, that was non-productive, that was desert and rocks, is an agricultural giant. Feeds itself and feeds so many others outside of the land of Israel, exports. It's just amazing. And that is in fulfillment of the blessing that the Talmud told us would occur, that when the Jews would return to the land of Israel would produce for them. And that when there were no Jews here, the land would not produce. And here we see that. That's not just that the Jews are better farmers or that we're smarter agriculturally than anybody else. It's the fact that the land responds to us because of the connection that we and the land have to the Torah and to the God of Israel, and therefore it's a special place. And the holiday of Shavuot represents that. More than anything else, it represents that holiness of the land. And I mentioned to you that we would talk about some customs. One of the customs is, we'll get to the cheesecake, don't worry, but one of the customs is the recitation of the prayer of Akdomos, especially in the Ashkenazic synagogues throughout the world. And this prayer was written in about the 12th century by Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir, who lived in Worms and in Mainz, in the centers of Jewish scholarship and Jewish life in the Rhineland in Germany. It's written in Aramaic. And it's recited at the onset of the Torah reading. Now, the question is, when is it recited at the onset of the Torah reading? This is all a custom because before the 4100s, nobody recited it. It didn't exist. So you can't say, well, let's see what the Talmud says. The Talmud didn't have Akdomas. And the custom is found in the works of the Maril, who is the father of all Ashkenazic customs. And he writes that the custom is to call up the first person to read from the Torah, the Kohen, and he should say the first blessing over the Torah. And that the Torah reader should read the first verse of the Torah reading for Shavuot and then stop. And after the first verse, then Akdomos should be recited. And this custom became so strong that it spread throughout the Ashkenazic world. And even here in Israel, even in some of the Sephardic congregations, it exists. And there's a custom here amongst the Sephardim that they say a poem written either by Reb Shlomo Ibn Gabirol, the great Spanish poet, or by Reb Yudah Levi, in honor of Shavuos, in honor of the Torah. The poems are just absolutely gorgeous. One of the difficulties in our time is that we have lost our poetic taste, so to speak. Maybe it's the Lithuanians within us, but whatever it is, these poems are just gorgeous, and they're recited in the middle. Now, how are they recited in the middle of the reading of the Torah? You're not allowed to interrupt in the middle of the reading of the Torah. So, here we have the famous idea Jewish custom overrules. You know, we're not going to be that technical. It's the great holiday of Shavuot. We have this immemorial poem, Akdomas, that was written and was accepted by so many thousands and thousands of Jews, by hundreds of generations. So we read it. Okay, we read it. So it's fine. And even though it's written in Aramaic and many people would find it difficult to understand what it says, though today the poem is translated here in Israel into Hebrew, and in the English-speaking countries there are a number of excellent translations that are available that you can follow along with it. But in any event, how does that happen? So they say, well, that's custom, and custom overrules. However, throughout the ages, there's been a dispute. Jews like to debate matters. And there were many rabbis that said that Akdomas should be recited before calling up anybody to the Torah. That, for instance, is the custom in my synagogue here in Jerusalem. And that's the custom in Shaarei Chesed and in other original Lithuanian synagogues here, because they... Excuse me. Because they said that it's not correct to interrupt the reading of the Torah. We have a famous case. There was Rav Arya Leib, the great scholar, the Shagas Arya. He was in the 18th century, was one of the greatest of the Talmudists. So he was a rabbi in a community, and they read Akdomas in the middle of, after the first verse, and he protested, and he really protested, so they fired him in the time-honored tradition of the Jewish people. And it became a very sticky point over all of the years, so that the rabbis finally decide that whatever the custom of the synagogue is, that's the custom of the synagogue, and you should leave it alone. The other custom that's in dispute has to do with flowers and plants in the synagogue on Shavuot. The Medrash says that when the Torah was given on Sinai, the Jewish people surrounded the mountain with all sorts of beautiful floral arrangements, and that as a memorial to that, commemoration of that, so then we have flowers and plants and beautiful floral arrangements in our synagogue as well on the holiday of Shavuot. This also came into dispute because floral arrangements in a house of worship is de rigueur in other faiths as well, not just in Judaism. And the Gaon of Vilna was of the opinion that even if the custom originally was Jewish, but if it was now taken over in the non-Jewish world, it was now part of their service, so to speak, then we should abandon the custom. And therefore, in the many Lithuanian synagogues, the custom has been abandoned. However, here in Israel, almost every synagogue has floral arrangements to mark the holiday of Shavuos. And we have records in Germany and in Western Europe how floral arrangements for Shavuos was an honor, and people, so to speak, outbid each other in order to donate those floral arrangements. And I remember in the synagogues that I was fortunate enough to be a rabbi in the United States, we always had beautiful floral arrangements for Shavuot, even though the Gaon of Vilna disapproved of the custom. But again, we see that custom many times conquers even great rabbinic opinion. Even when the rabbinic opinion is correct, the custom somehow overrules it. And then we have the custom of having the Ramov mentions it already, of having a dairy meal on Shavuot, eating dairy foods. So even though ordinarily on a holiday we only eat meat foods and drink wine, etc., but on Shavuot we always have something dairy as well. So there are many reasons given for that custom. The primary reason was that until the Torah was given, the Jews could eat whatever they wanted to, and now all of a sudden they had a whole new set of rules, and therefore they didn't know what to eat, so they ate what was safe, and that's dairy. But there are many other reasons given for the custom of having dairy food. I think a lot of it has to do with agriculture, again, that the dairy foods are more or less not from any other origin. Even the milk, etc., naturally comes from the cow and cheese, etc., but it comes basically without the loss of life and without avoiding any of the agricultural laws that exist for Shavuot. And it's become very, very traditional to have the dairy foods. And here in Israel, it's an enormous industry. Starting now from Lag BaOmer on, you have ads in the paper and in the radio, all the media from the dairy companies. And I saw that last year almost 30% of all dairy foods consumed in Israel were consumed in the month between Lag BaOmer and after Shavuot. And so, cheesecake is an important item. It should not be minimized. And the Jews always like to commemorate holidays with certain types of foods. And the foods are representative. Not only are they delicious, but they're representative of ideas and the deeper thoughts that exist within the holiday itself. So we see that Shavuot is replete with all of these wonderful ideas, so that even though it's not explicit in the Torah what Shavuot is all about, except for the fact that there was a special sacrifice brought in the temple, and except for the fact that it was the beginning of the period when the first fruits were brought to Jerusalem. But the Jewish people have developed the holiday, have created it, so to speak, and have therefore given it the patina of holiness and of acceptance, and Jews look forward to it and enjoy it, as I hope that each and every one of you, my dear listeners, will enjoy the holiday with your families, and that it will be the harbinger of the acceptance of the Torah and the rebuilding of the Jewish people and of Israel. Now, my friends, I have a commercial that I want you to listen to, if you'll be kind enough to do so. Destiny Foundation is a foundation that I head, that I founded, and it provides media, educational material. It brings the story of the Jewish people to the Jewish people. We have many, many projects. We are involved in the curriculum of hundreds and hundreds of schools all over the world. We distribute our tapes and MP3s and everything. And we are a purely voluntary organization that exists through the help of good people such as you. We are looking for members. To become a member of Destiny, you have certain privileges. You have a monthly private telephone call with me. You have a free newsletter, the Wine Press. You have a substantial discount on all Destiny products. But more than that, even if you don't have any monetary benefit, you have the benefit of helping bring the story of the Jewish people to the Jewish people. And I think that there's nothing as important in our time as that. Jews who know who they are, they know where they came from, they know our story, those are people already that are committed to being Jewish to the extent that they wish to be. But people who know nothing, we're the people of the book, and they don't know what book you're talking about. So then it's very, very hard to reach them, and it's very hard for them to remain Jewish, and it's very hard for them to have a self-identity and a self-worth. So Destiny Foundation tries to help that, and you're going to try and help Destiny Foundation. So become a member. You can go to the website, rabbiwine.com. Everybody in their modesty should have a website named after them. And if you go to rabbiwine.com, and you'll see all of everything that's available. We have courses online, education online, anything that you want, really. And there's over 1,000 different lectures to listen to and to peruse. And I would love to hear from all of you. And I thank you very much, and I wish you a very happy Shavuot to you and to all of Jewish people. And may it be again a time when the Torah will be accepted and appreciated and followed. Thank you again for listening.